Welcome to ReligionWise, the podcast where we feature educators, researchers, and other professionals discussing topics on religion and their relevance to the public conversation. My name is Chip Gruen. I'm the director of the Institute for Religious and Cultural Understanding at Muhlenberg College, and I will be the host for this podcast. In this, season two of ReligionWise, we will continue to consider a broad variety of religious and cultural beliefs and practices, and try to understand their place in the contemporary conversation. If you like what you hear, I encourage you to explore the 12 episodes from season one that are available in your favorite podcast app. Also, we would love to hear from you with your questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes. To reach us, please visit our website at religionandculture.com. There, you will find our contact information and also have the opportunity to support this podcast and the work of the Institute. Today's conversation features Matthew Akins, an author and reporter who has covered both Afghanistan and the Middle East since 2008. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and Rolling Stone magazine. Akins received the 2022 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting as part of a New York Times team that investigated civilian casualties from U.S. airstrikes. The video investigation that he and his colleagues produced also won two Emmy Awards. He has also received the National Magazine, Polk, and Livingston Awards. His debut book, The Naked Don't Fear the Water, which was published by HarperCollins in 2022, tells the stories of Afghan refugees as they flee Afghanistan, traveling overland towards Europe. His reporting for the book comes from his own experience, accompanying his Afghan friend as he heads westward, encountering both help and hindrance towards what he hopes will be a better life. I would also like to highlight his reporting about the fall of Kabul. As a freelancer, he was able to stay in the country when most other journalists were recalled by their editors. I would recommend his piece that appeared in the Times on December 10th entitled Inside the Fall of Kabul, which gives a close-up view of the final days of the Afghan government and a portrait of the city after its eventual fall. Particularly with the war in the Ukraine, Afghanistan has slipped from the front pages of the newspapers and from the national conversation. Given the long history of the United States' involvement, as well as the long history of our own ignorance of the place, it seems necessary and fitting to welcome Akins to the show to share his view of this complicated and troubled country. Of course, on ReligionWise, we like to think about religious and cultural diversity and how they impact our world and the public conversation. I think this is a really good example of how religion and culture get wound up in economics, politics, warfare, the refugee crisis, and many other aspects of the human stories as they unfold in Afghanistan. I think as we move beyond the headlines and think about individuals as they operate in their own worlds, we can see more clearly how religious identity, along with myriad other identities, affects how they live their lives, the choices that they make, and their own worldviews. Akins' reporting, because it is so on the ground, and so visceral when confronted with individuals from Kabul, from Afghanistan generally, we can put faces and names with the larger story, with the larger headlines, and think more particularly about the individuals and how they're affected by the geopolitical and economic forces all around them. Matthew Akins, thanks for agreeing to appear on ReligionWise.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So first off, congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize for your reporting in Afghanistan, as well as the many other awards that you've earned in the last several years. It's quite a string of accomplishments.
Well, thank you. So
I want to come to the specifics of some of those pieces that have appeared in the New York Times and a variety of other outlets, Rolling Stone, GQ, et cetera, and then also to your recent book that we will talk about in a little bit. But first, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your own background. It's both really interesting personal history and I think important for understanding your work. So can you tell us a little bit about your transition from being a young traveler to then becoming a freelance journalist?
Sure. Well, I went to university in Canada, which is where I grew up. And then after I graduated, I wanted to travel and see the world. And I was also interested in being a writer, being a freelance journalist. So I set off in the spring of 2008. I flew to Paris and then started backpacking, hitchhiking, couch surfing my way east. spent the summer in the Balkans, and I had the vague idea to go to India and wanted to go overland. So on my way through Central Asia, I realized it was easier to get to Afghanistan to get an Afghan visa than it was to get a visa through Turkmenistan, which was the other route. So a bit by accident, I found myself crossing the Amu Darya River into northern Afghanistan in the fall of 2008. And this is at a time when security in some parts of the country was still manageable in a sense. And there were backpackers or independent travelers going there, but it was quickly becoming a bad idea. I actually learned, though, that I, because of my half Asian heritage, I passed for Afghan, and I started learning the language and traveling around the country, having adventures, and started writing stories about them. And that was how I got my start as a foreign correspondent, by writing about the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and so you to this day, you're still a freelance journalist, is that right?
That's correct. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, because it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about your one of your most recent pieces in the Times, Inside the Fall of Kabul, is that the New York Times got all of their people out, right? But yet, because you were a freelance journalist, you weren't bound by those rules by your employer. So you were able to stay on in country. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that experience of everybody else leaving, you staying on as the Taliban is getting closer, as the government is getting shakier and shakier. What were you able to see and document that some of your colleagues were not because they had to leave?
Well, on the day of the fall of Kabul on August 15th, I and my housemate, the Belgian photographer Jim Hoilebrook, who was also a freelancer working for the Times, we went out to the outskirts of the city and actually witnessed Taliban fighters entering Kabul. And there were crowds in the streets cheering them in that area, and we really felt like we were being present for history.
One of the things that I find interesting, and I noticed inside the fall of Kabul, as well as in the book, you describe the community of foreign contractors and workers, et cetera. And it seems like, you know, going all the way back, I mean, in the book to 2014, like people see the writing on the wall, that there is a sense of kind of impending of an instability, but yet that instability goes on for 7 years. I just wonder about what that community looks like. I mean, I guess I'm just struck by the building of that international community of workers, the NGO, the military people, the government people, the foreign contractors, and being inside, as you say, inside watching this history unfold, but then also having this kind of sense of what's coming. I mean, am I reading that right? I mean, did that sense of instability go that far back to 2014?
I went back even further. I mean, the thing is that this community, this group of expats and everyone who worked with the foreigners in Kabul knew that bubble world was required the input of, you know, billions of dollars every year, right? So it was a boom town, but everyone knew that it was going to come to an end. And what was created as a result of this huge influx of spending, you know, both development aid and also military contracting, and they knew that it was what was created as a result of it was not very lasting. You know, it was again very much focused in the short term, and I think everyone knew that once the money ran out, that most of these people were going to leave. So people were in it for the short term in many cases, and they were looking to get out. Both the foreigners, of course, who came there often to make a buck or their careers in Kabul, but also a lot of the Afghans who. Especially the elites who were funneling this money out of the country and feathering their nests abroad in places like Dubai or London. And when the rubber hit the road, they all got out. And they've been preparing for this moment. It came a lot sooner and more abruptly than I think anyone imagined in terms of the fall of Kabul, the sudden collapse of the government security forces. But it was definitely something that the elite had been preparing for, and they were out the door.
While a lot of people were short timers. You would not be described as a short timer in Afghanistan. I mean, you first, you know, get there, I believe it's in 2008 or shortly thereafter. You still are returning to do work there. I mean, you've been there almost a decade and a half at this point. In her review of the book, The Naked Don't Fear the Water, Jessica Godeau describes the book in her review in the New York Times as, a quote, a profound act of love. What do you think she meant by that? And do you think that is an accurate description of the book?
Well, love is a theme that runs through the book. It's the love of Omar for his family. You know, Omar is the main character. He's the refugee and the friend that I followed on this undercover journey along a migrant trail from Afghanistan to Europe. And so the love that held his family together over their many decades of exile, because Omar was, of course, like many Afghans, a refugee in his childhood. He grew up in an exile in Iran and Pakistan, and in very difficult circumstances. But the determination of his mother, especially to hold the family together and to provide a future for her children in the midst of extremely difficult circumstances, was a result of a kind of love. Then there's Omar's love for Layla, the girl that he falls for and decides he has to leave Kabul to get a chance of winning her hand. But there's other kinds of love too. There's love, the figure of the beloved, you know, is something that I refer to in the book. So you have Sufi poets who are singing the lyrics to the pop songs that Omar's listening to. And there are other poets who describe, you know, the beloved as the revolution that they hope for and can no longer rationally believe in, but nonetheless have faith in. So the book depicts many kinds of love and the fact that it is love that drives people to move in these journeys, to take incredible risks, to try to seek something. And perhaps the depiction of love is itself an act of love.
Yeah, I want to follow up a little bit on the mention of the Sufis and the Sufi poetry and the songs and so forth, because that is something that is a recurrent theme. I wouldn't say it's the main theme in the book, but it's something that is sort of a refrain that happens. And I would really like you to talk a little bit more about how that, you know, how that is a part of the culture and how that is a variety of the Muslim experience, the Muslim worldview that you don't hear as much about, particularly in Afghanistan. And in particular, one of the things about Sufism that's so interesting to me, it is about love, but it's also very much about loss and longing, longing for the divine that is in transcendent. But it seems, I mean, poetic is obvious, but it seems very fitting to the situation that a lot of your characters find themselves in.
Yeah, well, you know, Sufism has a very long tradition in Afghanistan, Central Asia. That is where, famously, the poet Rumi originally comes from. And so these classic poems are very much part of popular culture there, and very famous contemporary or modern singers like Ahmed Zaher often use lyrics from people like Rumi and Hafiz or Shiraz in their songs. So it's something that people... it's very much in the vernacular, and this Sufi idea of mysticism, and as of life itself as a form of exile from God and God's presence, you know, lends itself to these depictions of the traveler, the wanderer, the journey, and of course, so this kind of language, these tropes, are very often used by Afghans to talk about their own exiles. You know, the experience of Afghans for the past 40 years has been one of repeated cycles of displacement and exile because of the war. So this feeling of longing for what you're separated from is something that I think corresponds very well to some of these Sufi themes. And for the Sufis, of course, you know, what these worldly forms of exile or these worldly journeys were just a or kind of reflection of a fundamental spiritual form of exile and a quest for God. And for me, it was interesting to draw on some of this imagery and some of this poetry, partly just as a way of bringing to life the spiritual and emotional world of someone like my friend. But also, I think it helped to infuse our journey with, I think, some of the more ineffable elements of a quest. Because I think what we forget in migration, especially forced migration, which is often depicted in kind of humanitarian terms, impoverished, suffering, desperate people, is that there are, of course, you know, all sorts of spiritual, intellectual, and ideological layers to this. Their experience in those terms by the refugees themselves. Just because you're a refugee doesn't mean you stop thinking about God or politics or you know, romantic love. And in a sense, I think that is what connects this particular experience that we went through, or the people I write about the book went through, to a much more universal experience of our search for, you know, for meaning, for a kind of union in the world across what are these borders, these fissures, you know, the very stark inequalities and political systems that divide people on the planet, for example.
Yeah, and it seems to me like what you detail in the migration is, you know, obviously, you know, hunger, exposure to the elements, all of those things that you talk about. But the cultural difference, I mean, can't be overstated either here, that you're, you know, that land route to Europe is, you know, the things that you think about as you think about, as you say, God and politics and so forth, as you move across Western Asia and into Europe. I mean, the culture around you is changing, how you are perceived as a person is changing as well. So I think that cultural difference must play a huge role in how people are, you know, feel that sense of meaning or feel, you know, the belonging or in most cases, the lack thereof.
Yeah, definitely.
So I want to go back a second, and I made this connection in my mind, and I just want you to either confirm it or correct me on it. But so the Sufism that, as we've talked about, is sort of running through your description and your descriptions as both a fact on the ground and also as a metaphor for these larger things that are going on. And, you know, one of the major sort of components of Sufism is not only the poetry, but as you say, putting those poems to music and some of the rituals are associated with dancing, all of which are frowned on, that's maybe not strong enough, all of which are banned by the Taliban because of their interpretation, their understanding of the Sharia law that they want to impose. I mean, is there a correlation between the kind of Sufism that you experienced, that you saw, and maybe the more, I mean, it's the wrong word, but the more liberal or progressive elements, not only politically, but culturally in the country?
I think that Sufism is often interpreted by a Western audience as, you know, being this kind of more liberal or more, frankly, Westernized form of Islam. And we can only see the kind of egregious uses that mistranslations of Rumi have been put to, you know, for kind of self-help books, Deepak Chopra and Chris Martin and stuff like that. But
right.
And there's no doubt that there's some truth in that. But Sufism is very much part of Orthodox traditional Islam, and there are many Sufis who think of themselves very much as strict or even fundamentalist in some ways. You know, what's I think not well known is that Mullah Omar, the founder of the Taliban, himself took part in Sufism. You know, he had a Sufi peer at one point, like he was a follower of a Sufi leader in southern Afghanistan. This would have been a very austere form of Sufism, where I don't think there would have been any kind of instrumental music used, but it was definitely part of his practice. Some of the stuff around, you know, worship around veneration of graves and interpretation of dreams that we hear about in the early Taliban are very much Sufi practices, and they're sort of part of the folk religion in Afghanistan as well. And so Sufism is not necessarily opposed to a kind of strict or more austere Islam. Now, it is true that some of the more modernizing trends in political Islam, you know, like Wahhabism, are explicitly anti-Sufi or anti-native practices associated with Sufism, such as shrines around graves. And I think that the Taliban today have been increasingly influenced by these larger trends within political Islam. So they have been influenced by Deobandism is some kind of more modernist strand of fundamentalist Islam that you find in South Asia, and Wahhabism. I think that a lot of the Taliban have been influenced by that. But again, at the village level, at the folk level in Afghanistan, including among, you know, places where the Taliban come from, you do find a lot of these Sufi practices, like the interpretation of dreams, the use of charms, amulets, certain forms of meditative prayer. They're very much alive and well. Music has instrumental music has a particularly controversial status within Islam, and definitely the Taliban have banned it, and they're quite explicit about that.
So one of my goals on Religion-Wise is to get people to take religion and religious diversity seriously, which is of course why I'm keep coming at, you know, thinking about Sufism and its role here. But that differences in worldviews can often help us to explain people's actions. And I think that sometimes that the public conversation, whether it be in academia or in journalism or in government, can sometimes get this wrong by not taking religion seriously. How do you think that religious ideas impact the situation and governance in Afghanistan? I mean, obviously the Taliban is a religious organization, but it seems like the public discourse can sometimes doubt the sincerity of the Taliban's religiosity, and therefore imagine it as a cover for baser motivation. So it's really about power or control or wealth or what have you. You know, do you think that having a firm grasp on the kind of religious difference and the, you know, the understanding of Islam by the Taliban leadership is helpful in understanding their motivations and how they're operating within the country?
Well, I think it's kind of a misunderstanding of political religion in general, not just Islam, that you can't have people who are both very sincere about their religious motivations and also are operating, you know, for purposes of power and politics, right? That the two can coexist. The Taliban are very sincere about their faith. I was struck now in the last year that I've been going back to Afghanistan since the Taliban taken over. We've all had an opportunity to speak with them, to sit with them, to see some of the other side. And there's no doubt that this discourse around Islam is very important, and it has a very strong disciplining and kind of regulatory effect on the movement. And yet they are a political movement, they are seeking power, and they have all sorts of worldly motives as well. So I don't think it's really one or the other. What we misunderstood in Afghanistan, I think, is just how traditional and Islamic of a society it is. And we've been obsessed with these kind of westernized images that we, you know, that for us are symbols of progress. So the Afghan women, for example, you know, taking the burqa off and having them go to school, having them study robotics, having them skateboard, you know, all of which are fine in themselves. And I'm really glad that, you know, some girls got to do that stuff. And I think every girl should, every person, including girls, should have a chance to do what they want in life. But if we became kind of obsessed with these symbols, and I think told ourselves a story about Afghanistan and what Afghans wanted that was very much at odds with reality, which is that for large parts of the population, their own traditional idea of Islam is very important. And when they saw that being threatened, they reacted. And that was one of the drivers of support for the Taliban. You know, whether it was accurate or not, there was a perception that a lot of what was happening in Kabul, under the influence of non-Muslim, you know, foreign countries pumping billions of dollars into a very corrupt elite, was un-Islamic. And that was just a powerful motivating tool for the Taliban. It was very simple for them to explain why they were fighting. And I think it became increasingly difficult for government soldiers and police to justify why they were fighting for an elite that was so corrupt and backed by foreigners who were on their way out the door.
Yeah, one of the things when you read the reception of your work and the reviews of your work, one of the things that people say repeatedly, and I think this should be a badge of honor, is that in your writing, there's not, you know, the black hats and the white hats, right? There's not the good guys and the bad guys, but that there's very complicated human stories, right? That there are people with motivations that grow out of their own contexts, and people operate not only in their own interest, but in the interest of their communities. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the complicatedness of the characters, about the people that you interview and that you feature in your work?
Well, I think that complication is something that becomes apparent when you actually get on the ground and you begin to get to know people. They trust you enough to tell you perhaps the real story behind some things rather than one they think you want to hear. And you, as you learn more, you begin to see just how immensely complicated it is. And so what you're then trying to write against is this very powerful, mystifying force that accompanies war and power, that is produced partly by propaganda and psychological warfare that were part of the mission there, and partly just by, I think, you know, larger discourses within the media, if you want to call it Orientalism or whatever you have it, but there's just this incredibly powerful mystifying force that wanted to paint the conflict as one between good and evil, right? And obviously we're on the right side, we're on the good side. So what we are doing is supporting the good guys against the bad guys, the Taliban or someone who's coming from outside, coming from Pakistan. And we're trying to help communities defend themselves against them. When in fact, the truth was, this is a civil war. This is a war that's incredibly complicated, and it's often cousin against cousin, or even brother against brother. It's tangled up in, you know, 20 years of conflict before that, and we are pumping weapons and ammunition and money into it to turbocharge it and fight on the side of people who are often doing, you know, involved in crimes just as bad as the Taliban were in terms of torture, extrajudicial executions, rape. So that was the truth of the war, but we, you know, and so there was just this consistent attempt to mystify it, to paint it as the struggle between good and evil. And I really did feel that my task and the task of journalists, you know, who are trying to find the truth, was to struggle against that mystification. And I think it led us badly astray.
So to come back a little bit to something you mentioned earlier, your ability, because of your own personal appearance, and this obviously plays a role in joining with the migration to Europe with Omar and the others, that you have the ability to pass. You have the ability to pass as Afghan, and Afghanistan, of course, is not a singular place. Lots of different linguistic traditions and tribal traditions and so forth. So that makes it maybe a little easier as well. But and I wonder. I was thinking about that also as a theme through this of passing, but also belonging and a sense of belonging that you know, people want, right? People desperately want. But yet the history of Afghanistan over the last 50 years has made that really tremendously difficult. You know, what do you think of that read about belonging and passing and identity being, you know, being significant themes for not only people in Afghanistan, but people then as refugees and migrants?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, as I was saying earlier about, you know, love and exile, I think that it's important to try to connect some of these experiences that we associate with forced migration in Afghanistan in particular with more general human conditions, like the dislocation and the feeling of rootlessness of even exile is something that's obviously very much a part of the modern world, is produced by the technologies that shape our world, that cause us to, you know, move cities and mix cultures, and this feeling of dislocation, this necessity of past to be translated, to translate oneself, is something that is particularly acute with migration and forced migration. But I think that all of us can understand on some level, insofar as we have left the traditional rooted lifestyle. So there are many kinds of passing in the book. The act of passing that I do, you know, as an Afghan refugee, as an Afghan undercover, is something that, as I point out, is rooted a little bit in that almost imperialist tradition. You know, Richard Francis Burton and imperialist explorers like that who went over and traveled beyond the periphery of the empire by disguising themselves as natives. But it's by no means restricted to them. You know, there were other passers who you know, Afghans passing as different sects, and migrants who are passing now as Europeans to get through borders. And so there's this idea of identity as performance, and that is made manifest at moments at the border and moments of translation. But in fact, is I think the fundamental condition that we live under, where we are all, in a sense, performing identities, and we're performing them in relation to, you know, much bigger structures of nationality and class and race. And so traveling like this is a way to, I think, examine them in this passing and make it more visible.
I want to bring it back to something else you mentioned in the book, and you know, it seems to me your perspective on this particular issue on identity and belonging, maybe a little less on passing for other reasons, but certainly on identity and belonging, is also rooted in your own family's complicated history. Can you talk a little bit about how that affected your understanding of ethnicity and race and a sense of belonging?
Well, my father's side of the family are European, you know, mix of Irish and French and English, and they're from Canada. But my mother's side came from Japan at the beginning of the 20th century, and they were, you know, put into the internment camps during World War II, which was, you know, a racist act of state violence against American citizens. It's now acknowledged to be a kind of shameful period in our history, but at the time was very much supported by the public. And then as a result, I think they very much tried to, the Japanese Americans, that is, tried to assimilate. And that has come in a sort of broader cultural and racial moment, or post-racial, as some people like to try to call it, moment in America, where the let's say the definition of what's a normal white, you know, the whiteness in essence, you know, is now much more multi-ethnic, to the point where me as someone who's a mixed race, who would have been seen as, I think, not white and foreign, you know, a generation or two ago, is now just part of the mix, and I could just kind of blend in a city like New York, place like that. And I don't have to think about my race. I don't really experience racism like my Japanese ancestors did. So I've inherited a kind of white privilege, and the paradox of that allowing me to now pass as an Afghan, so some of the most vulnerable people, you know, in the world, I would say, people were hunted by the U.S. military, and who are, you know, profiled by anti-terrorism, you know, mechanisms, the borders, and or cast out as asylum seekers. So to go from being a privileged American male, you know, straight citizen to passing as an Afghan is maybe a little less surprising or less difficult to understand when I think about the experience of my Japanese forebears and to be in that camp in Lesbos, inside barbed wire, you know, made me think about them. And I think we all have stories like that in our past if we look back far enough. And it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't automatically mean, I don't think, have some kind of ethical import, because that kind of is the story of human history, is people rising up to the top and then staying there, right? Regardless of what maybe they suffered a generation or two ago. Sometimes that can make people all the more determined to cling to their privilege, remembering the hardship they faced, or the people faced, repeating that violence, you know, as we see in a place like Israel, for example. But I do think it just offers a way, you know, to think about these stories, to acknowledge them. It does complicate things. It does give us, I think, at least possibility empathy, and creates fissures maybe in the solidity of our privilege.
Looking to the future, one of these questions I think will be easier for you to answer, and one of them will be a little bit more difficult. But looking to the future, I mean, what do you see for yourself? I mean, you seem to still have the opportunity to travel back and continue your reporting in Afghanistan. So what do you see professionally for yourself there? And then sort of more broadly, what do you see in the next 10 years, generation, for Afghanistan from your experience there?
Well, we absolutely do have an opportunity to go to Afghanistan now as Western journalists. We don't know how long that's going to last. The relationship between the Taliban and the West is not improving. And so that might not be the case. But while we're able to travel there, while we have the privilege of traveling there, which a lot of Afghans don't, because they don't feel safe reporting in Afghanistan, if they're reporting critically the Taliban, then we have a responsibility, I think, to use that and to keep a spotlight on the country. So I'm going to keep going back and reporting on it. I was just there in May and wrote a story. I also think it's just a very interesting time to be in the country, because it's suffering a massive humanitarian crisis, there's an economic collapse, U.S. sanctions have crippled the economy. I mean, there's so much that's going wrong in Afghanistan right now that we have a tremendous responsibility for, but also very limited means now to influence. I'm speaking, you know, in terms of the West, but it's fascinating because you now have access to the other side of the war, and in the countryside there is peace. The fighting has stopped for the most part in a lot of places, for which people are grateful. And so you can travel to areas that were very difficult to access before, talk to people, and I think that now is an opportunity to write a fuller account of the war and what happened. Or maybe a revisionist history that can cut through some of that mystification I was talking about earlier. As for the country, I mean, it's obviously difficult to predict. I think that on one hand, the prognosis is not good, because if you look at the root causes of the conflict for the last 40 years, those have not really been addressed. The Taliban have this moment of peace, but it doesn't appear clear that they're able or willing to use it to broaden their base, to reconcile with groups that have been marginalized. They still have a lot of problematic links with groups like Al-Qaeda. And so they are possibly wasting a historic window of opportunity that will close and will have a resumption of kind of fragmentation and civil war that we've had at other periods. And that those are, of course, the most disastrous periods for Afghan civilians. But on the other hand, you know, the most important cause of civil war in Afghanistan has always been foreign intervention, whether Soviet or American or Pakistani or, and so right now there is a consensus, I think, among all countries that have an interest in Afghanistan that no one wants to restart a civil war. No one wants to fund an armed opposition to the Taliban. People would like to see a bit of stability there. And that could change, especially the Taliban continue to harbor transnational terrorist groups. But for now, there hasn't been, you know, significant external support to the armed opposition. So that, I think, is on the plus side. But Afghanistan is going to go through a very, very difficult time. It's still one of the poorest countries in the world. It was one of the most aid dependent. The sudden cutoff of that aid has had predictable consequences. So Afghans absolutely need the world's support, and we should be punishing the entire nation collectively for our failure or for the Taliban's misdeeds. And we shouldn't forget that over the last four decades of an almost impossible situation for Afghans, one of their most persistent and effective survival strategies has been to migrate, has been to leave, you know, a country where you otherwise you'd face starvation or violence. And they've left, and they've mostly gone to neighboring countries. Like most refugees, they go to Iran and Pakistan, but then others go further. They go to the Middle East, they go to Europe, they've come to the US, and they're not one-way journeys. Afghans are often coming back and forth. They've formed over the last four decades transnational communities, a diaspora that has been helped the country survive more than anything, more than foreign aid, has been the remittances setback for people who are working. And so we should see that for what it is, a survival strategy. And if we pass restrictive immigration laws, if we make it harder for refugees to integrate, to visit each other, to marry, to study, then we're going to strangle the life of that community. We're going to choke off, you know, one of the very, very few things that responses that Afghans have now to this total failure of the international community in this long-suffering country.
So where I always try to end up, and I think that you deal with this a little bit in some of your articles as well, but where I always try to end up is if I am listening to this podcast, and I want to educate myself, or I want to have a positive impact, if there's something that I can do. I mean, in some of your pieces talk about how, you know, that we in the international community want to salve our conscience with, you know, with token gestures that don't quite go far enough. What do you think sort of your the listener to the podcast can do to have a positive impact on this tragic situation?
Well, I think there's very little that we can do that will have a, you know, deep impact on wars overseas or global inequality. These are collective problems, and they're beyond the ability of any one individual, even if it's the president of the United States, to solve. It belongs to the realm of politics, and I think it's been sort of a question of what are your listeners' politics. But on an individual level, there is a lot that we can do that feels meaningful to us and to other people. And that is another thing I've tried to depict in the book, is just how faced with impossible situations, impossibly big situations or tragic ones, individuals nonetheless act according to their consciences to help each other. And so if you are appalled by what's happening in Afghanistan and you would like to do something, then there are Afghan refugees, tens of thousands of them scattered across the U.S. So there's almost certainly some in your community who you could help. Get in touch with the community groups that are receiving them. You could just take someone out to the park and help them feel a little more at home. You could help them set their cable bill. You could donate money. You could donate your time, whatever it is. I think it's important to act in a way that will feel meaningful to ourselves as well. I mean, it is altruism, but I think in order for altruism to be effective and lasting, it has to transform us as individuals too. And that means, I think, becoming emotionally engaged in what you're doing. And so I think it's less a question of, is this going to change the world? Is this a deep enough change? It's that, how are you going to change yourself? And how are you going to do it in a relationship of, you know, a real accountability and love with another human being, in a way that, again, does reflect your politics, your idea of the world.
All right. Well, Matthew Akins, thank you very much for appearing on ReligionWise. This has been great. Super fascinating. And congratulations on your work and good luck in the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been ReligionWise, a podcast produced by the Institute for Religious and Cultural Understanding of Muhlenberg College. ReligionWise is produced and directed by Christine Flicker. For more information about additional programming or to make an inquiry about a speaking engagement, please visit our website at religionandculture.com. There, you'll find our contact information, links to other programming, and have the opportunity to support the work of the Institute. Please subscribe to ReligionWise wherever you get your podcasts. We look forward to seeing you next time.